All right. Hi, guys, and welcome to this week's episode of A Glass for Every Palate. You guys can't see me, but I might be fanning out a little bit because today's guest is somebody that has inspired me and that I've idolized for such a long time. So let me run down this list. Chef, author, restaurateur, humanitarian, host, media personality, the list goes on and on and on and on. Today's guest is Chef Marcus Samuelson. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. How are you?
I am doing well. We are so happy to have you. So here on A Glass for Every Palate, I try to frame every conversation with a theme. And when I was thinking about you and your work and what it's embodied, I thought of the word Renaissance because I thought of, you know, you being from Ethiopia and bringing that to your Scandinavian cuisine and then bringing that to Harlem. And there's always something of a rebirth and innovation and creativity in what you do. So that's going to be kind of the essence of our conversation. Does that work for you?
Yeah, it's great. And it's also actually the 100th years of the Renaissance in Harlem. Basically, it's the anniversary this year, 100th.
Yes. So perfect, perfect, perfect. So let's begin in Harlem, since we're there now. You are one of the proudest Harlemites I have ever seen, truly of the community, in the community, multiple restaurants. Red Rooster is a staple. The Brownstone is one of my favorite cocktails ever anywhere in New York. Let's go back to, Red Rooster opened in what, 2010? Funny enough, I went to like a Zagat dinner before you actually opened there. So it's such as a joy to see that it's still there and thriving and kind of the epicenter of the community. So when you thought of leaving Aquavit, you live in Harlem. What conceptually, like when you first thought of it, what kind of restaurant did you want to open?
Well, I knew I think there was a lot of emotions and thoughts that reflections. I work best when I kind of like think through my next step. And so for me, I go back to after 9/11, I started to ask myself really questions. Why am I in New York? Should I stay in the city? And being from a beautiful Sweden, I could easily go back. But it was also, I recommitted. It was like, I love this city. I love this place. But I was really searching for a community, sense of belonging. And I think as a Black person, as a Black chef, I wanted to be, I've read so much about Harlem and its Renaissance and incredible community. I felt like, you know what? Let me move to Harlem. So I started that phase of moving to Harlem. And in 2003, 2004, I moved to Harlem and with the intention of opening a restaurant.
Okay.
But I didn't feel like I knew Harlem. So that was like a 6-7 years journey for me to just to understand and learn about my community, speak to the Lana Turner, speak to the Thelma Golden, speak to the Bevis Smiths, and fully understand. And as many things in our community, Black community, many things starts underground. Some of the best things that comes out of our culture is very official to us, but it might not be official to a mainstream culture. And
right.
There was no difference with the food. The best jerk chicken for me was not in a restaurant. It was in a park. The best cornbread was also not in a restaurant. It was some beautiful lady that made it in at church and brought it to church. You know what
yes.
I mean? So
yes.
the good is in our community are right there for us, but there might not be for everybody. So I felt like there's a mystique. There is a juju. There's a sense of life here that I want to discover and be part of and broadcast.
And that's so interesting. I think that a lot of what people sometimes don't recognize is like that we are not a monolith, but we can always find a point of connection to our truest self and our truest roots. So I remember there being like with the whole kind of resurgence and rejuvenation of Harlem, there was some pushback and some critique about, well, why are we putting these fancy restaurants in these neighborhoods? Like these are not true to the community but they are if the soul is there. So how did you deal with kind of that, with kind of knowing that this is, at the core, you're Ethiopian and you have this amazing, incredible worldly influence that has impacted your life. But now you're in Harlem, a place where food is so essential to community, and you're bringing a cuisine and your take on it that isn't, you know, somebody is going to say, right or wrong, that it's not as authentic as it should be, but you're elevating and you're pushing. So how did you kind of reconcile like being true to who you are as a chef and being true and respectful of the community and the traditions of things like fried chicken and cornbread and jerk and all these other cuisines that are the essential fabric of these communities?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think that learning about the community, learning about the place was very valuable for me. And I think when you have pushback of something, I think that's really positive because it means that people care. That means that people say, hey, make sure what you do matters. Make sure you are referencing this place and do your homework, you know. And I think it's great that, you know, think about it. Harlem is essentially Black capital in the world, right? That's where intellectuals, yes, cultures, people from all over the world in our diaspora come to Harlem to present, whether they go to the Apollo if you're in music, or whether you go to present at the Studio Museum, or whether you go to the Schomburg. And I have to go through these great institutions as well. So pushback is not necessarily bad. It means that people care. And I really received and heard that and took that information to heart. And you brought up that we're not monolithic. We're definitely not monolithic. We have our diaspora is vast, it's large. And it was important to acknowledge and hear a lot of people. So for me, I translated that from hiring from the community, creating tours within the community. And it's a healthy back and forth that I don't think is to check the box and you're done. I think as Harlem and as our community and our city is forever changing. You know, think about, we talked about 9/11, you think about Hurricane Sandy, and then you think about what's happening right now in COVID and post-COVID. We're constantly moving. So that dialogue is never ending. And it's about being in the community and of the community and constantly learn and evolve. And there's many ways to do that. So we celebrate that through art, through food, through music, of course, but through culture. And I'll tell you, the other day, I was just walking down Lenox, coming from the restaurant to home. I need to change something. So in the middle of the day, well, maybe like 5:30, 6 o'clock at night in the afternoon, there was a huge Haitian band on Lenox Avenue just set up, right? And they played for a good hour. They performed. And you could tell, and because it was a huge group and lots of people coming. And I was like, only in Harlem is this organically happening. Only in Harlem is this happening, where not only does the band know what to do clearly, but there were dancers, not dancers that were hired, dancing, people were dancing from the audience. There were people knew what to do. They knew how to appreciate the band by not just applauding, but also like passing the bucket and paying them. And I said, only in Harlem is this organically happening. There was no sign that this band would perform. Everybody stopped in the day, applauded them, celebrated them. And these type of stoop performances that are happening throughout Harlem and have had happened throughout Harlem during the pandemic, pre the pandemic, will happen post. That's just some of the magic that happens organically in our community.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing to see. You know, I think about the juxtaposition of when Street Bird existed too, and kind of the essence of like us as people, as sometimes you want a formal meal, right? You want a restaurant where you're going to get a lot of technique-driven food and all of that stuff. And sometimes it's just been a crappy day and you just want to sit down, have some wings and a good drink. The energy can be on 20 and you're good. So, I mean, I think that the restaurants and the spaces that you've built and created in Harlem are very much in tune with the needs of the community and how we as people experience life. You know, like sometimes, yes, it's been a great day. Let's go to a fine dining place and have some champagne and some exquisite cocktails. And maybe it's smooth jazz that's playing and it's art around us. But I think that, you know, in addition to respecting culture in that way, I love to cook, but I'm actually not a cookbook person. But I have been obsessed with The Rise because one, I fall in love. You know, this podcast has so many wine-centric guests. And I always say what I love about wine is the stories. And your new cookbook is so captivating with the stories. How essential is it? And I think that this is something that's true to chefs, and I hope that you can shed some light on this for us. How much of your cuisine, your restaurant concepts, your books are really tied to like the soul and the story of how a dish comes to life?
Well, mood and eating and celebration and food and spirituality and food are all connected, right? And I think that, when I started cooking, very often it was confusing to me because the techniques were all French, but the food I love was maybe my grandmother's food that was just as good and delicious, but technically it was just different techniques, but sometimes they're crossroads. But the value proposition, you never saw articles about your mom's cooking, about your grandma's cooking, but you saw articles about French cooking. So what media and what was perceived as good food or fine dining was one thing, but really what my heart spoke to was one thing. So I learned early that whatever I'm reading versus what I love can be many different things, right? Mm. And so the core of a dish and how we celebrate a dish is plurethal. Also, as a Black person, I never saw our images around it, which juxtaposes to today, where you have things like Hind the Hog, where you have things on like, my friend Chef Kwame just celebrated, family reunion in Virginia.
Love it.
Right? And then you have things like the rice. So we have so many things where we, as people of color, as Black people, can come together and celebrate all of our emotions and skills and our thoughts and gather. That wasn't what was possible before. But I tell you what, we wouldn't be here without, for me, very often, the aunties, the great aunties in Black cooking, American cuisine, like Miss Leah Chase, like Edna yes. Lewis, like Sylvia Woods. So the rice celebrate the past, the present, and the future of our culture. And hopefully someone will take that and be inspired by that and do their own version of that. So when you are a young cook or somebody that are a consumer of our culture in terms of food, you know where to go. You know where to gather.
Yeah. And it's such an interesting thing to watch when you really follow food. I think that some of the most acclaimed chefs in the world have kind of reimaged and reinvented and represented the dishes of their childhood. Like, how many chefs have redone ratatouille in a different way? How many chefs have, Massimo is known for redoing lasagna in a way that it's never been done. Jose Andres has redone. And yet, for some reason, when it comes to the food that's the epicenter of Black culture, it's always been viewed as lower, and less than. So to see chefs like Mashama, like Gregory, like Eduardo, like Kwame, and like you, have your food elevated to show like, this is complex food. This is creative food that belongs on this pantheon with everything else has just really been, it's a cultural shift that you love to see. Let's transition into some fun stuff. So with your feelings and emotions towards food, you've been a judge on a lot of shows. How difficult is it to judge someone else's food knowing that this might be a great dish and I just don't get it? Like, I don't have the reference that this chef is using. How hard is actually judging other chefs?
Well, I don't even know if judging is the right word, because I look at it from, I know we're there to judge and separate certain dishes and elevate certain things. But for me, it's really about see the soul of the chef. What was their thought? What did they actually try to say with this food? Did they execute that to the highest level? For me, I don't think certain food is lower and certain things is higher. For me, it's really about, did you execute this through the best of its capability? And the craft of cooking, once you feel and see the craft of cooking, that's the essence, right? Then that craft can speak different languages and have different techniques. But for me, it's not like French cuisine is a higher level than, let's say, food from Nigeria or food from Ethiopia. I don't look at it like that at all. I've traveled so much. I've cooked in so many places, from Australia to South Africa to Ethiopia to the White House. So, and all of the, all in between. I lived in Japan. I lived in France. So for me, I've seen so much food and yeah. Love sort of the funk, the smells, all the experience around it. But what was she trying to say? Did he or she execute on their dish? If they did that, then I go to, okay, they're really trying to tell a story here through their food. And it's up to me to connect and understand that. I would never have a preference of a European dish than I would have of a South American, or vice versa. It's just
execute the dish
that you want to do. And within that, tell your story. You know what I mean? And you talked, I just want to go back a little bit to what you said before also. The moment we go in now through food to share, just like you said about those great chefs, Mashama, Nina, Kwame, and so many, is a lot of the things that we've added to American culture, pop culture, very often came from our basements. And it wasn't fully understood as it was presented out to the broader world. But eventually became a moment, it became the culture. We can talk about it. Jazz, rock and roll, house music.
Whatever
music and hip hop, of course.
I'm from the Bronx, hip hop.
Started in, yes, of course, right? So therefore, food, our food culture storytelling, there's no difference. It very often starts with our culture, that is the place of gather, whether that's Jamaican culture, influenced in Haitian culture, infused Ethiopian, tells Mary somebody from with Southern traditions, right? And there you have it.
Yeah, it's so organic the way it happens. And I think that conflict arises when we try to force, like there's an organic way, because I often think that we look at music as the universal language. I actually think it's food. Chicken is chicken is chicken is chicken. No matter where you eat chicken in the world, a chicken's a chicken. It's recognizable. And what a culture and a people and a place do with that can vary an infinite amount, but it's still that. So I love this idea of food being kind of like the universal language that we're starting to speak in, and that we're respecting and understanding where everyone else is coming from. You know, right now we are between COVID, natural disasters happening everywhere. Chefs, I think, have really stepped up to the forefront of humanitarian work. And it is incredible to see. Do you think that, I know that it's a combination of just wanting to help and all of that, but do you think that there's something inherent in chefs that like just have to feed and do and be selfless in their approach to life?
I think that the world crisis, the local crisis, you know, in one way, there's always been crisis. I think I would say the difference is today we're connected through them in a different way because of social media and the way everything gets reported. But, you know, I always think there's been a level of crisis moments, but we didn't know what was happening in a place like Afghanistan before, let's say 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago, right? So I don't think that if you measure crisis, global crisis, I think it's about the same, right? How do we then deal with that in terms of our own and something like when the pandemic happens, and it happens in every community all over the world, right? It's just a very strange thing for us, for this. You have something global left like Afghanistan that we, you know, that we can now talk about. But then think about ourselves coming out of the pandemic and being in the pandemic and how we all respond to it so differently. It's a challenge. It's a huge challenge that is, as humans, that is put in front of us. Yeah. And we get so many mixed messages, right? You have at the same time billionaires becoming even more billionaires or having their race to sending things to outer space. And at the same time, you have, you know, local communities really, really struggling. So what do we do with all of that information? And I think cooking has always been a place for the chef that we can come to, no matter what, no matter how noisy it is outside of us, I can come to the stove. I can touch food. I can translate these incredible ingredients. And it calms us. People look at chefs and say, like, it's such a stressful job. When you talk to the great chefs, it's calming to cook. It's calming to share your story. It brings me pleasure and a set place of center when the world is so loud and fast around you. During the pandemic, yes, we served enormous amount of meal at Red Rooster, and we served it together with World Central Kitchen. But it became my place that I knew I had to get dressed up for every day, go to work, and place. And it gave me a sense of belonging in a time where it was super difficult, when everything was scary. Should we shut the restaurant? What's going to happen? What's going to happen to everything I've done? dealing with not being bitter about this opportunity, right? Also yeah. realizing my privilege that having access to healthcare and my family staying healthy. So all of those things, right? So again, I look at it, musicians sometimes in the world can be extremely noisy, but the best music is coming out at that time. How can that be? Because I think that's how we are as yes. a chef. I think that some of the best food ever is being cooked right now and is waiting to get presented. That's why if you go on TikTok or any Instagram or any social media, you see people are cooking all over and they share it.
Yes. Yeah. And it's beautiful to see. You know, it's so interesting and so important that you brought that up. You know, I work in healthcare, so the pandemic was exceptionally stressful for me. And one of the things that kept me calm and sane was I never write recipes. So, you know, all of the tradition of my grandmother and great grandmothers that taught me how to cook the food of our country. I'm from Belize. I have no written record of it. I know how to make it, but I've never written it down. And that's something that I was able to really do during the pandemic was create these things and relive these very, very happy times in life and then catalog it. And so that it can carry on to the next generation. So out of that, I ended up with written recipes of dishes that only existed in my head or in my mom's head or in my aunt's head. So it's been amazing to see how people that have never cooked are baking breads and all of this stuff. It's beautiful to almost witness like this global joy of cooking coming up. It's crazy. You have cooked for some incredible people in some incredible places. So I have to ask, do you ever get nervous? Like, has there ever been a dinner, a place, or a person that you're cooking for where it's like, oh, I'm a little nervous about this one?
I'm nervous all the time. I think that balance between jitters in your belly and are excited about something should never go away. Mm-hmm. Because if you nerves are part of acknowledging there's a moment here that is exciting, right? Yes. I remember being super nervous cooking for my uncles when I was 12 years old because it was the first time. They were fishermen, so they knew everything about fish, but then maybe not about cooking. I was nervous cooking for the first time in France in this 3-star Michelin restaurant, but getting over those hurdles. So I think logistics, nerves, all of that, it's also part of being a chef. It's like, wow, this is the moment. But as you're doing the event, again, I turn into being calm. And I was very nervous cooking at the White House, not so much about the food itself, but the logistics around it, right? Because some of those things that was in my kitchen, I couldn't control that. When President Obama came to our restaurant to eat, I wasn't nervous because he was coming to our house. And I was in control much more of the logistics. The food and the presentation of the food, that is not nervous for me at all. Because that's what I raised to do since I was 16 years old. I've been doing this all over the world. So I know that but there's so many other things that can happen. But that's also what makes it fun. And it's like, you wake up, you gather the team, we're doing this journey together and we're sharing that with the team on the way back. That's something that can almost not describe. Looking at that young cook in the back, that I was part of the team cooking for the Swedish King when I was like 18, 19 years old.
Oh,
eventually,
wow.
When I was a chef at Aquavit, I started to cook for the royal family. But all of those things in 18, 19 helped me to be at that moment because I knew the logistics. So you never know when you bring a team on, who in the corner is going to be the person that's just going to walk up and eventually do the event, you know?
First of all, you guys cannot see Chef, but the passion that is in his words, it is emulating from him. If you see it right now, it's beautiful to see. Mm. And it's interesting that you bring up that I think that that's a very unique experience that people that like to cook have had, like the first time you have to cook for your family, especially if you have a family that will have no qualms about telling you if it's not good. That's nerve-wracking more than anything else. Wow.
Yes.
I didn't even think about that, but yes, that can be quite nerve-wracking. And I know a lot of families, my family in particular, won't hesitate to tell you if something isn't good or they don't like it. And that's fine. And it's fun because you grow and you learn from that. I am beyond thrilled about all the people that you've cooked for. You've also opened so many doors. So many great young chefs have come through your doors. As a mentor and as a teacher and as an advisor, how would you describe your style of kind of cultivating and growing and bringing out the best in new chefs or younger chefs, I should say?
It's all about sharing the journey with the person. Where does she want to go? Sometimes he or she doesn't know that at that point. And then it's part of you to guide and set up goals that are attainable, but also that you can crush together, right? Mm-hmm. So mentoring someone like Tristan, our chef in Miami, that started 8 years ago. And today he's the executive chef of Red Rooster. But for me, it was talking to Tristan, talking to his mother. They traveled all over the world. So I knew he had perspective. You know, he's a Trinidadian kid, but raised in the Carolinas and in Texas. But he's also lived in Portugal and spent time in Peru, right? So this is he has a global reference point. So he came with us to stay in Sweden for a while, just to be in a different environment. And I knew he was ready for that because for him, that was a path that he'd been used to before, right? Other chefs, like someone young like Tiana that works with me, her journey is different. So it's all about first understanding where do they want to go, what environments would be suitable for them at this moment. And then 6 months later, a year later. So this is a long process. You know, I've known Tiana since she was 18 and today she's maybe like 24. You know, she's one of the chefs for Bon Appetit now and has her own YouTube channel and so on, right? And it's been on Chop. You know, so each one of these chefs, they're very unique, they're self-motivating to begin with. So there's very little. And then you have more established chef that calls me all the time about, hey, I need a real estate guy that helps me get a lease or something like that, right? That's just part of being a chef and being an uncle, because guess what? I had those chefs. I could call Miss Leah Chase anytime. Mm. And she guided me constantly. I called Chef Charlie Trotter. I still call Chef Danielle, for example. Right.
Wow.
So I called Jonathan Waxman. Like, there's so many people. Like, I want to speak to someone like Nancy Silverton. Like, there's so many people in our community. That's why cooking is such an incredible family, because there's always a chef that is going through or have gone through what you're about to do, and you can share that experience. And I love, you know, getting a call from Kwame, or talking to Mashama, or talking to Nisha Arrington, or Nina Compton. It's my favorite part of being a chef. It's that, hey, how can I assist you? How can I help?
It's community. And so much of, like, we talked a little bit on it earlier, of like the interconnectivity of the world, like social media and all of this stuff. You know, there are pros and cons to everything. But I think that as technology across the board has improved, the way we're able to connect with each other and help and grow and really create communities is so essential to how we are as people. Before I jump into our like rapid round thing, I have to ask you, what's next for you? You have a beautiful young son that's growing that we absolutely love watching you play and have him grow up as a child in Harlem and experience all the joy of that. What is next for you? What have you still not done that you want to do?
Oh, I mean, for me, it's being part of food, being in it fully. You know, like, I'm excited to have the opportunity to curate the Met Gala that we decided that this year it's going to be all plant-based, right?
Wow.
But it wasn't just about making the plant-based. It was about finding the 10 chefs that's going to do it as a collective, right? And who are these chefs? Who are these incredible people? And broadcast that and say, hey, we're going in a different direction, right? And we need a moment of joy coming out of the pandemic, right? And it should be a celebration. Further out in spring, looking after the new year, I'll open my next restaurant in Chelsea. I'm very, very excited about that. And, you know, so there are so many things that I'm part of that I, you know, and again, like I am, but you said something interesting first. You said you had the dinner pre-Red Rooster. I did about a year of pop-ups just to try out the food, just try out what's working, what's not working. That's essentially what I'm doing now. I'm doing pop-ups like this weekend. My chefs and I were going to Black Bear Mountain in Tennessee to cook the food for the new restaurant, right? So there will be selective dinners, very much the way a comedian would go out and try out her or his new material. Right.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing now. I'm out essentially what I'm calling it's almost like a listening or tasting tour of that work, that did not work. This needs to take off an ingredient here And so that's what's happening right now. So we're getting ready to cook at Blackberry Farm. We're very, very appreciative of that.
That's amazing.
Yep.
I very much remember that restaurant. We were downstairs in Ginny's Supper Club. There was a lemon like crispy couscous that was absolutely delicious. I'm still waiting to see that on the menu because I loved it. I'll never forget that. One of my favorite grains. But it's so, and that's the thing to understand about, like, I think that now more than ever, people are recognizing chefs as artists, right? And even an artist that is painting or dealing with a new medium or using a new medium, there's trial and error in it. And the beauty and the fun and the joy and the growth is in developing and seeing how people react to it. And I love that. We have to talk a little bit because you mentioned a plant-based menu. What do you think about this? You know, I always, even as a person that absolutely loves cuisine, I am always conflicted about, I think it's amazing that we are all making a push towards sustainability and really taking better care of the planet that we live on and all of its resources. I also struggle with the idea that I can go to 23rd Street and pay $350 to eat all vegetables. That is an amazing menu, by the way. I loved it. But if I go 120 blocks or 100 blocks north, there are food deserts where I could walk around and not be able to find asparagus or anything but iceberg lettuce. And that's a very interesting juxtaposition on an island that's only 13 miles long. So as we move towards, you know, we look at all the health crises facing urban and inner city communities and how a more plant-based approach to diet would be more helpful. But you can still get a burger, fries, and a soda for $4, and you still have to pay $12 for a salad. So as you move towards these things, like, how do you think we push the envelope in cuisine and really appreciating and respecting and doing our part to save the earth and its resources while recognizing that we need to create a lot more equity and access to healthy foods for a lot of communities?
Yeah. Well, it's a very layered question, but I think what you just said that explains how we are as humans, right? We many things, right? We demand many things. And the food apartheid that exist in our cities, they were crafted for us, right? As horrible as that sounds, we all know that that's reality. It's not like these communities that just happened, right? But that goes back to Jim Crow. Right. And we are now doing everything we can to get out of that. Right. But that just didn't happen. Right. That's man created. And that is built in, of course, in racism, as many things are in our country. And there's no point of denying that. It's just a matter of how do we fix it? Right. In a city like New York City, you should have a high and low. You should have a deeply diverse, different dining scene, vibrancy of that. So it's important to have expensive, but it's also very important to have affordability, and it's very important because both of those will push the middle, which is the majority, right? So yes, it's super challenging and difficult, but plant-based is present and future. And what we doesn't mean that we're not going to at all have animal protein, but we have to shift in the amount of intake. And, you know, if you look at cultures like India or Ethiopia, for example, or other places, very often you eat the meat or the fish to break a fast. And when you eat it, you might eat just 3 or 4 ounces of it. It might be a supplement to the grain or to the vegetables. And here we do it the opposite. When someone's like, oh, I have a 14-ounce steak. No human is ever going to eat that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's such a great way to kind of set that as an example. And I think that that's how we'll have global change. If everyone does a little bit to change, we'll have more of a shift. And I really do love seeing it. And I also think that it's beautiful to see that every chef that is kind of pushing it, whether it's high end or wherever, there's a give back component to it where they're also using, you know, if it's fine dining, it's a luxury and some people will always partake in it, but using those profits to also give back to the communities that surround them and the people that work in their restaurants that oftentimes are not going out for, you know, really expensive meals because they can't afford to. So it is beautiful to see that we are doing better at creating this ecosystem where everything is kind of connected and feeding into the other.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, Jeff, this has been such a joy and a pleasure. You have shared so much wisdom with us, and it is truly a testimony to you and to everything that you've done that the passion emulates in everything that you say when you're talking about this stuff. Guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode. I am smiling ear to ear. Tune in next week for another episode.